You're listening to the Sex and Psychology Podcast, the sex ed you never got in school and won't get anywhere else. I am your host, Dr. Justin Laymiller. I am a social psychologist and research fellow at the Kinsey Institute and author of the book, Tell Me What You Want, The Science of Sexual Desire and How It Can Help You Improve Your Sex Life. I recently heard the term ethical gangbang for the first time, and I have to say that it really piqued my interest. This is a term that, to many people, probably sounds like an oxymoron. Like, how can a gangbang be ethical, right? So I thought it would be fun to do an episode on this topic. In today's show, we're going to talk about what an ethical gangbang looks like and speak to a porn director who recently released a film featuring an ethical gangbang. Some of the topics we'll dive into include how things like consent and safety are managed when filming a group sex scene, the difference between objectification and empowerment in adult films, and how consumers can identify ethical erotic content. We'll also talk about how the growing war on porn and increasing legal restrictions on accessing adult content are shaping the porn industry. My guest is Erica Lust, an award-winning indie erotic filmmaker who creates sex-positive adult cinema by portraying realistic characters and realistic hot sex. Over the past 20 years, Erica has directed 6 feature films and series and over 130 short films. In 2015, Erica gave a popular TEDx talk titled, It's Time for Porn to Change. Erica was a guest on the previous episode where we talked all about ethical and feminist porn and her approach to making this kind of work. So if you haven't listened to that one yet, be sure to check it out. This is going to be another amazing and fascinating and very eye-opening conversation. Stick around, and we're going to jump in right after the break. If you love the science of sex as much as I do, consider becoming a friend of the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University. The Kinsey Institute is the world's premier research organization on sex and relationships, and you can help them continue the legacy of Dr. Alfred Kinsey, whose pioneering research changed everything we think we know about sex. Visit kinseyinstitute.org to make an impact. Your donations can help support ongoing research projects on critical topics. You can also show your support by following Kinsey Institute on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Thank you for supporting sex science. Okay, Erica, let's talk about ethical gangbangs. Now, before we do that, let me first ask a definitional question. So in general, what does the term ethical porn mean to you?
Oh, there's no easy definition there. This is going to take a while because obviously when we're talking about ethical, everybody understands this word in a different way. For me, somehow ethical is about trying to do it as good as you can, being aware of the process, having standards and protocols and listening to other people and their opinion and having all the important conversations. That's part of kind of how to work in an ethical way, whether it's porn or something completely different, right? If we're talking about porn more technically, then I would say that it's really about making sure that consent is in place, that everybody have had their say on what they like, what they don't like, how they feel that particular day, and that they know that someone is looking out for them outside the camera, outside the director and the producer, that they have someone, a talent manager, an intimacy coordinator that is there for their well-being and that they can count on in case there are difficult situations coming up, etc. Because I think we all have to be aware that there might be situations, and that's why this process is so important.
Yeah. So thanks for sharing that. And I totally agree with you that, you know, the term ethical is something that's going to mean different things to different people. There are different definitions of this out there, but I appreciate you sharing yours.
And also, sorry, but many people mix it up with morality somehow. Yes. They start thinking, oh, what is that? and how can that be used? And the funny thing there, I used to say when we're thinking about what's ethical, etc., there are institutions that have been, you know, sitting on their high horses when it comes to morality, like the church, for example. But we all know that inside that institution, many of the worst things have happened. So these are very, very complex issues. It's important to remind ourselves about that.
Yes, very complex issues indeed. So let's talk about what an ethical gangbang is. Now, to a lot of people, this term might seem like an oxymoron, right? Because they can't wrap their head around the idea of how a gangbang could ever be ethical, because in some people's mind, it's always inherently exploitative. So what does an ethical gangbang look like?
Mm-hmm. Well, here we go again. This is like also talking about feminist porn. Some people think that they could never go together because feminism is one thing and porn is one thing. Ethical gangbang, what would that mean, etc.? I actually think that we're talking about the same concepts, really, going back to what is ethical porn, etc. It's making sure that the people who are involved are living their fantasy, that they are sharing what they like, what they don't like, what are their boundaries, how they want to be treated, that it's being consensual in all aspects. So I think that what is happening is that many people, when they think about a gangbang, they see a bunch of guys that are somehow preying on a woman, that they are being sexually aggressive towards this woman. But actually, if you're thinking about it, and if you listen to someone who likes to do gangbangs, like in this case, for example, Katsumi, who's an actress that I worked with in this film, she explains that this is one of her absolute most important fantasies. She likes the idea of being the one in the center, the one who's deciding what she wants, who she wants to do it with, who's communicating her feelings with these guys at all time, and living her absolute most fantastic fantasy the way she sees it. And the way, when I started to talk to more and more women, I realized that there are actually quite many women who have this fantasy of having many lovers, of being the princess in the party somehow.
Yeah. And, you know, this ties in with my own research on sexual fantasies. You know, multi-partner sex is the single most common type of sexual fantasy people have. It takes a lot of different forms. Threesomes are the most popular form, but a heck of a lot of people in my work mention gangbangs specifically, right? This is a common fantasy across genders, across sexual orientations. So, you know, there's nothing unusual about it in that regard.
No, and then when we're talking about fantasies, I also think it's really important to remember that sometimes fantasies are just fantasies. Sometimes for people, it's just something that they like to think about, to desire, to maybe even watch, but maybe they don't want to actually do it in their real life. And that is one of the things where porn can actually come into work for us, to make that fantasy, to be able to watch it, to see how other people would live that moment, but in a safe place, in a safe space where you don't have to act yourself in that situation. Some people want to have their fantasies in just that safe space. Other people want to live them out in real life. The only thing we can see for the people who want to make their fantasies come through in real life is please try to do it as safe as possible, having in mind an ethical way of connecting with these other people that you are engaging in the activity.
Yeah, definitely. So you mentioned you have a new film. It's called Katsumi's Party, and it features an ethical gangbang. So I'm curious to hear a little bit more about the idea behind this film. So was it the performer coming to you saying this is something that they want to make, or was it you saying, I want to make an ethical gangbang, who wants to participate? How did it come to be?
No, actually, I had never filmed a gangbang. 20 years of career as an adult filmmaker, I had never done a gangbang. I was part of that group of women feeling that maybe that was a bit too much for me as a person to get into. But then I met Katsumi. We started to talk about making a film together. She's an adult actress, and she told me she loved my films and the way I, you know, feature the female gaze and women in charge. And we started to talk about different ideas of what should this film be about. We didn't really know. So we were exploring this new friendship, getting to learn a bit about each other. And during that talk, I realized that the talk in itself was a powerful conversation that maybe other people could really relate to. And I decided to make a film that kind of started in this conversation that I'm having with her. So I'm actually kind of co-starring in the film myself, as myself. And the film takes off with our conversation. And then little by little, it gets more and more intense until she reaches the point where she's together with five guys. And when it comes to the performers, that was also very much her choice. I wanted her to work with people that she felt attracted to. So I kind of lined her up with a bunch of different performers, actors that I thought could be interested. And then she did interviews with them and decided in the end who she wanted for this film.
Yeah. So, you know, as you're describing that, I appreciate everything that goes into this, because I think a lot of people who might watch a film that features a gangbang, they might assume that someone just shows up and the director says, okay, you're going to be having sex with these five people today and here you go. But no, like there's all of this consent, negotiation, respecting for boundaries. Like there's so much that goes into it.
And it's a long process. It's also about, you know, her appearance, what she wants to look like, the whole stylism, the makeup, the hair, the set, the art decoration, the style of the whole film. You know, when we make films, what I do is that I gather with my whole kind of film crew, my director of photography, my art director, my, you know, stylists, etc., and we brainstorm together until we have a whole kind of mood book about the style for a film that we want. It's pretty an artistic work behind it. And then obviously the whole script writing process and all of it that goes into one of these films.
Yeah, there's a gangbang mood board of, you know, these are the different features that
there
I want.
There it is.
Yeah. Love that. I'm going to create a gangbang mood board.
This is maybe what people should do for their own home weekend sessions. Yes. Think, what role play are you going to play this weekend? And then you do a bit of a research. You get to write your own little story, your own little script. And then you send a proposition to your partner. You discuss it. And on Saturday night, you're ready.
Yeah, fun project for the week. So how do you coordinate a group porn scene? I mean, it's one thing when you have just two performers. And we talked in the previous episode about, you know, intimacy coordinators and how they work with each performer, you know, with the boundaries and consent. But it's a different thing when you've got this whole group of people. So how do you manage consent and safety and boundaries when you've got a complex scene that involves, say, six performers at the same time?
Well, it's really talking through it a lot, making sure that everybody is aligned with what we are doing. And then I am, together with my intimacy coordinator, behind the screen checking that what we have talked about is really what is going on. And that obviously we do for every scene. I mean, I've been filming sometimes a sex scene where with the performers, we have agreed on the use of condoms. And in the heat of the scene, suddenly you have an actress not remembering that that was what she wanted. So good thing for her, the team behind the camera, we have our checklist, we know, and suddenly we run in, stop, wait, you forgot the condom. So it's kind of having sex with service. We are ready with the towels, with the wipes, we have the lube, we have the water. You know, the performers can always cut if they want a break, if they want to go to the bathroom, if something feels off or is not working the way it should. The conversations we had before have been together with me, the intimacy coordinator, and all the performers. If we don't live in the same city and we cannot meet, we do it online where everybody have their turn to talk through what they want and what they want, don't want. Then we also have everything documented on paper where they fill in. So we make sure that everything is signed, that everybody have seen it and understood it. And then on the day for a shoot, we go through all this again to see that nothing has changed and see if, because obviously you can be in a different mood than you were the week before. So it's an ongoing process, and it even ends in a check up after a shoot to make sure that the day after or a few days after, nobody suddenly feels that something didn't work the way they wanted. It's a lot of steps on the way. And when you have also so many people on a set, there's also a certain dynamic you have to look through, right? So nobody gets left outside. So everybody feels that they are working together in this scene.
Yeah. So definitely a lot that goes into this. Now, you mentioned there's all kinds of communication that goes on beforehand where you talk about what is going to happen and boundaries, limits, all of this. So I think an interesting question is, how do you balance like all of this planning and preparation that goes into it where that might lead it to feel kind of scripted versus presenting an authentic depiction of sexual pleasure? So where's the balance between, you know, having the communication and planning and then also still having it feel like an authentic sexual experience?
I kind of think that the more planned it is, the more talk through it is, the safer people actually feel, in the more they feel that they can live out that moment when we're on, when, you know, we go and action. They know already so many things beforehand, right? But for me, it is also important that what we shoot is feeling good at that moment, and to make sure that that is happening. It's basically the timing. We need a bit of a time. We cannot be on a really, really tight schedule. Because then people will get pressed into, you know, finding their orgasmic moment, etc. Because for me, that is also an important part of the project. I want people to have as realistic pleasure as they can. And I think that is about trying to create a set that is very, very planned, but that feels intimate, and that we kind of try to get out everyone who's not needed in that space. We don't have, you know, the whole crew standing around watching everybody. No, there's the, you know, the camera, the sound, the still photographer, me, intimacy coordinator, are behind the monitor. And then we take all the other crew members, we take them away so we can create that intimacy.
Yeah. So definitely, again, so much that goes into all of this. Now, I think another interesting question in the world of porn is what makes something empowering versus objectifying. So in ethical porn, we often hear about how the scenes are empowering for women. And in mainstream porn, we often hear about how scenes are objectifying for women. So how does a scene look or feel different when it's empowering versus objectifying?
I think it's a lot about the gaze, actually, how the camera is moving, what it's seeing, from what angles are you showing the situation. And what we see a lot in mainstream porn, example, is that the woman's body is what's almost always in the center of the image. When it comes to the men, little of his bodies, little of his face, little of his expressions are in it. Men are normally reduced pretty much to penises. So here it's also a question of trying to make that point of view also coming from the female character somehow, and to capture on camera the interactions that she's having with the male performers, where you see how she's managing what she wants at that moment and you see their reactions to it. For me, it's that communication I want captured, not only two bodies jumping kind of around on the sofa, but you don't feel the people behind these bodies, right? It's kind of finding the humanity in the characters.
Yeah. And, you know, that was something that struck me the first time I saw one of your films, was because I learned that, oh, like there's a different way to portray sex on screen that I had never seen before. And I think for a lot of people, this idea of like ethical porn or an ethical gangbang is kind of elusive to them. It's hard for them to picture because they've just never seen it before. But once you see it, then you realize, like this is a totally different way of watching, of experiencing porn. And like I said, you just won't know it until you see it.
No, and also to mention, because many people, when you talk about porn for women or feminist porn or ethical porn, etc., they start imagining something very, very soft, because somehow they mess it up with concepts of kind of it's feminine or it's soft or it's... And that's not it at all. The sex can still be very dirty, can still be very down, very hard, very raunchy or very... stimulating, right? It's not about that the sex has to be soft and you don't actually see anything, but it's more about what really goes behind it and how these people and their agency gets portrayed on camera.
Yeah. And case in point, ethical gangbangs exist, right? So it can show hardcore, it can show anything. And I think people's perceptions don't always line up with the reality. So as a consumer, how can you identify ethical porn? So, you know, anybody could go around claiming that their porn was ethically produced. So how do you as a consumer actually know that? So what should you look for if you want to support ethical porn?
Well, for me, one of the things is pay for it. If you pay for it, there's better possibilities that the people who have been working in it have been paid for making it. So let's start at that. But then when you navigate porn online, check out the pages that you are visiting. Are there an about page? Can you learn anything about that company, that director, the performers? Can you watch a making of from that film set? Can you watch a sex talk, an intimacy coordinated talk, so you get an idea of what did they actually talk about before this scene was filmed, etc.? I think that it's important to see if your values align with the values of that company or those directors, performers, producers who are involved in the work.
Thanks for sharing that. So we talked about this a little bit in the last episode, you know, how there's this growing anti-porn movement. And I just wanted to talk for a few minutes about how that movement is impacting you and your work. So, you know, in this discourse on porn and the mainstream media, there's no distinction between ethical porn and mainstream porn. You know, people just say porn is porn and porn is bad. And there's this growing movement to restrict access to it and to try and ban it. So case in point, in my home state of Indiana, there was a law that was just passed this year that makes it so you have to show ID in order to be able to access porn in the state. But that works effectively as a ban because nobody wants to upload their ID to a third-party site to have it checked and verified before they watch porn online. So people will just find ways to get around it. They'll use a VPN or something else. So I'm curious, you know, this growing movement to restrict porn, to curb access to it, has that had any impact on you and your work?
I mean, it had impact on everybody in this industry, from even sex educators to erotic artists to performers to companies to directors to everyone. It's not easy to make kind of a business in this industry. It's not easy to find support from banks. The payment processor fees are very high. There are, you know, censorship on social media. I hear I'm not even talking about publishing sexually explicit images. Obviously, we're not allowed to do that. We would never do that. But we are not even allowed to to show romantic images or kiss between two people, even if they are fully addressed, because of who we are. So yes, all of this affects the access and the visibility that we have. And I think that it's a pity that not more people are aware of the existence of a different kind of porn, whether we want to call it ethical or feminist or independent or artistic or wherever we want to go. But it does exist. And not all porn is the same, and not all porn is sexist and is the kind of a porn that you might encounter online on many of these free tube sites that are not really sites that are interested in human sexuality, because their main business is advertisement. They are there because they are selling advertisement to the audience. They're looking for traffic. They use porn to find that traffic. If people would like to see birds fly, then they would show videos of birds flying, because it's not really about the videos that they are showing. These are just the product that they are using. And I think that it would be great if more people would understand the business model of these sites. And I do understand that there's somehow a worry amongst people, what's happening to a younger generation, what's happening to their kids. Are their kids now watching porn online? Because obviously porn was never fought to be watched for people under 18. And for many, many years, it was easy to keep it from younger generations, because porn was something that you could only access if you were 18, if you had, you know, a credit card, or if you showed your ID in a store and you could, you know, get a video cassette or a DVD or a magazine or whatever worked at that time, right? But today it's true that the tube sites have put porn out there for free for anyone to access, whether they are under 18 or not. So I do understand the worry that many parents are having. I'm myself a parent of two teens, 13 and 16, and I've been in contact with many parents asking me how I do it, how do I talk to them, etc. So a few years ago, I even started a site called thepornconversation.org, where we have resources helping other parents and educators in how they can have these kind of conversations with their teens, because we know that they are using porn as sex education, even if porn was never, ever fought to be sex education, right? It's difficult because the age idea restrictions that are happening at this time, they are also affecting our privacy, because if we need to show our ideas to access porn, for me, it's easy because I think that put it behind a payment barrier. Then you know that the people who have credit cards are over 18 and they have the right to access it. They only have to show the credit card. They don't have to show their personal identity documents. For me, that is the solution. But obviously with these tube sites, and not only the tube sites, because porn is also on other sites. We have porn on Twitter. We have porn on even YouTube, even if it gets, you know, censored as soon as it gets detected, etc. But it's still out there. And like you said before, kids are tech savvy. They know how VPN works and they will find their way around it. So really, I think put porn behind payment barriers, educate the young generations about sex, because that's what they are looking for. They want to know about sex. They want to know about identity. They want to understand what attracts them, etc. So stop being so afraid of those conversations and get better sex education to our kids so they can make informed decisions for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, the only reason kids are going to porn to learn about sex is because they're not getting sex ed elsewhere. And so if all of the effort and focus is just put on, let's ban porn, let's restrict porn, but let's still not give anybody any sex ed, we're not doing anybody any favors. And, you know, they will just find a way to access it somehow. And that will still become this default source of sex education. So we need the sex ed. Banning porn isn't a replacement for that.
And also remember that it's not that porn is bad. I mean, some porn is bad. Some porn is great. That's the reality. The same as Instagram or TikTok or whatever is happening out there. Some of it is really, really bad. And what we need to be able to filter that is media training, is media literacy, and it's porn literacy. So let us make them have this kind of critical tools to understand what they are watching.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for this amazing conversation, Erica. It was a pleasure to have you here. Can you please tell my listeners where they can go to learn more about you and your work?
They can come to ericalust.com, and that's Erica with a K, because some people write it with a C, and I'm Swedish actually, so it's the Viking way of writing Erica.
So we have much more to talk about, and I'm really looking forward to continuing our conversation in the next episode and talking all about the subject of ethical gangbangs.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. To keep up with new episodes of this podcast, visit my website, Sex and Psychology, at sexandpsychology.com, or subscribe on your favorite platform, where I hope you'll take a moment to rate and review the show. You can also follow me on the socials for daily sex research updates. I'm on Twitter and TikTok at Justin Lehmiller and Instagram at Justin J. Lehmiller. Also, be sure to check out my book, Tell Me What You Want. And if you have a question you'd like me to answer on a future episode of this show, you can leave me a podcast voicemail at speakpipe.com/sexandpsychology. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.